Good evening, and welcome to tonight's live telephone town hall with Congressman Sam Farr. This technology allows Congressman Farr to chat with hundreds of his Central Coast neighbors while sitting in his office here in Washington. In a few moments, we'll be joined by the Congressman, but first, I'd like to explain what will happen during our hour together. At any time during the call, if you would like to ask Congressman Farr a question, please press star 3 on your telephone. You will continue to hear the conference call until one of our town hall assistants can join you and take your question. Please be ready to give them your name, your city, and your question. This will allow us to keep the discussion flowing and reduce repeat topics. If we can't get to your question during the call, you'll also have the chance to leave a voice message for the Congressman at the end of the call. It's a little extra incentive to join us for the whole hour. Finally, a recording of this teleconference will be available on our website tomorrow, so feel free to visit www.farr.house.gov and listen. Now, I would like to introduce Congressman Sam Farr. He served the Central Coast for more than 30 years as county supervisor, state representative, and now congressman. And again, if you would like to ask the congressman a question at any time, please press star 3 and a call assistant will be with you shortly. And now, joining us is Congressman Farr. Congressman?
Hello, this is Sam Farr, and I'm really excited that you can join us in this incredible technology. Using the telephone as a town hall meeting, so you can talk from wherever you are. And I'm here in my Washington office on a hot summer night. Glad to be in an air-conditioned office. But I'm excited that I get to talk to you. It's a wonderful technology. I'm going to be back in the district. Congress recesses for the month of August at the end of this week, and I'll be back in the district, and I'll be meeting with constituents and having town hall meetings, going to postmortems on the fire, and I look forward to seeing many of you at those town hall meetings if you have any other follow-up questions and if I can answer anything that isn't answered tonight. What I'd like to do is just mention a couple things that we're all being involved with, but what I think you need to know is that Congress passed the stimulus package, and the last stimulus checks, rebate checks, went out a couple of weeks ago. If you filed for that check and never received anything, would you let our office know first thing in the morning? We'll look it up and see what happened to that. I know everybody wants to talk about gas prices. They're outrageous. I have to fill up my truck and my wife's car, and it costs hundreds of dollars to do it. It's outrageous. I think the problem is really is twofold, and we haven't talked nationally about it. Unfortunately, the president hasn't provided any leadership in this area, but the area is the problem is caused by two things. One, America being so dependent on foreign oil to run all our transportation vehicles. We have had to import more and more because our transportation vehicles get so poor mileage. And the cost has gone up and up because there are other countries competing for that same oil, certainly India and China, which are bringing on millions of people who can afford gas vehicles or gas machinery, such as lawnmowers and things like that. So the demand is higher than it's ever been in history, and the prices have followed that demand. And there's no one quick thing we can do except for kind of playing a big gorilla in the oil market by releasing a lot of the oil that we have in our strategic preserve. We could show the cartels that we can play this game too. And that would bring down the prices right away because you would have flooded the market with oil that the United States government owns and keeps in reserve. That's a card that the president said he was not willing to play, so I don't think we're going to have any immediate attention to this. I'll talk more about other alternatives, but I'd just like to say one thing that I'm very proud of here in Congress is representing you in the state of California, because the state has done a better job than any other state, and certainly better than the federal government, in finding alternatives to energy consumption. We have the lowest per capita energy consumption in the United States in California. We have produced more alternative energy than any other state in the United States. We are aggressively seeking alternatives to transportation fuels. And I think that we're going to find the problem, the solution to the problem is going to come out of California, which is going to create a new boon and a new kind of Silicon Valley opportunity for jobs and opportunities. So I'm excited that the demonstration of the solution for the future is coming out of our great state. And I know we're doing a lot of things locally, which I'll mention in a latter part of the town hall meeting. But I thank you for joining me. There's a lot of issues out there, and I look forward to your questions. Let's begin.
Thank you, Congressman. Now we're going to move to our question and answer session. For those of you that just arrived, to ask the Congressman a question, please press *3 and a town hall assistant will join you on the call. Congressman, I'd like to start off the Q&A session with a question that has been big news throughout the Central Coast this summer, the mortgage crisis. Can you tell us what is new on that area?
Well, it has been a crisis, and I just saw the other day that the number one city in America affected by the mortgage crisis is Stockton, California. So it's not very far away from where we live, and almost 50% of the houses, I think, in Stockton were having difficulties in meeting mortgages and were being foreclosed. The Congress has reorganized the Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac by beefing them up. We've also raised the loan limit that they can give, so it's more practical to be able to participate in California purchases. Our attempt is to try to keep people in their homes and to work with the lenders and bankers to restructure the payments so that they're more affordable and to work out any way possible to keep people in their houses. For those that just got in way above their heads and there's no financial way to get out, we want to make sure that there are alternatives for them too. So we're working a lot with the local housing authorities, with the state of California. Obviously, there's criminal activities that have gone on, and we've got to pursue those. We're trying to attack this from every way possible, and hopefully if we can get a return around in the economy, we can recover. Yeah. So I'm really sad because I think that the people who are losing their homes are the least able to do that, and then we need to keep affordable housing in our neighborhoods or we're not going to have a workforce. So I'm working as much as I can with the state and local folks to see if we can bring the federal resources to bear.
Thank you. Again, callers, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, please press *3 at any time during the call, and someone will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Ray Thorpe from Hollister. Ray has a question for you about regulating the Enron loophole. Ray, you are
Thank you very much for doing this. This is a great idea and a really neat medium. It's very innovative and just quality. That's what I want just to start.
But thank you, Ray.
My understanding of oil price, it's really not based on a true cost to produce the oil. It's based on speculation. And a lot of what I've heard economists talk about is basically the Enron loophole that eliminates or doesn't allow a lot of regulation of this trading of futures of oil, which is truly what's driving oil prices up. What's your thought on that?
Well, thanks, Ray, for asking a question. I sit on the Agricultural Appropriations Committee, and it's the U.S. Department of Agriculture that's in charge of the commodity trading, and energy futures are part of that commodity board. That board trades about $5 to $6 billion a day, I can't remember, 500 million, I think, or it's 5 billion maybe, a percentage of it is, anyway, a significant percentage is oil futures. What we looked at is, are there speculative buyers? And since you have investors in that, particularly a lot of pension funds and big money interests who play the market, obviously you have to do it with some fiduciary responsibility. Is that driving up false spikes? The commodity regulators don't think it's a problem. However, a lot of us on the committee think it is. And so we've funded for further investigation and additional staffing to beef up the oversight of this. I think the jury is still out if we can prove it. But if we can, then there's criminal penalties that can come against traders like that. So it's an area that has not been regulated before. It's not regulated like the stock market is. And obviously there are loopholes in which you mentioned the Enron loophole is one of them. We're looking into it, and indeed if we can find facts of causality, we will deal with that.
Thank you very much. Our next question is going to come from Connie from San Juan Bautista. Connie has a question about state budget pay. Connie, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Hello, Congressman Farr. Thank you for taking my call. I really, really respect you, and I'm very appreciative as you that you serve our area.
Thank you, Connie.
But I just heard recently over in the news that the governor is stalling signing the budget and making comments about how he's going to have all state workers take a minimum wage until we all, you know, fess up to some sort of budget. And I was like, I don't understand what he's trying to do with this.
I sat, Connie, for 14 years in the California State Assembly, well, 12 and a half years, actually, staff to it before that. But I remember every one of those budget battles going down to the wire. The budget's supposed to be adopted by July 1st, and any day after that, it's late. And the requirement is, and it's the one that we were discussing today back here, although we don't have anything to do with it at the federal level, is that when Prop 13 passed, which was a property tax reform, Howard Jarvis' initiative also required that the California state budget be passed by a two-thirds majority. That doesn't exist anywhere in the federal government. It's only a simple majority for all decisions back here except impeaching the president. And that two-thirds vote has gotten people into these partisan bunkers. The Democrats, working with a Republican governor, are in favor of passing a budget. They can't get the votes necessary from the Republicans, who always find a way in which the budget is not good enough here or too much there. I found and went through all those battles that, frankly, nobody ever won or lost an election of how they voted for the state budget. There's so many issues in there, one could argue any part of it, but you don't lose an election on it. Unfortunately, they're at a stone wall in Sacramento. I think the governor can only use his administrative tools. He doesn't have very many, and he's threatening to pull those, of which you mentioned. But the real fact of the matter is that both Assembly and the Senate have got to sit down and work this out and give them enough votes to get the budget passed. I signed a letter opposing the governor's proposal to reduce all the wages at the state level to minimum wage. And those of us back here are kind of pushing the governor's office to get this thing done, and our legislative colleagues as well, but we don't really have a dog in that fight because we don't sit in the California legislature.
Thank you. Remember, if you have a question for Congressman Farr, press star 3 on your phone at any point during the call. You will still be able to hear what's going on, and someone will be with you to take your call shortly. Our next question comes from Ellen from Hollister. Ellen has a question about foreclosures. Ellen, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Hi, Congressman Farr. You and I go back a long ways, and I'm one of your, you're one of my heroes.
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, I don't understand why a house is going in foreclosure. They know it's going to be put up for auction, and they're accepting a minimum bid on it. Why the bank is going to know this, and why the person living in the home cannot negotiate with the bank to pay what they're going to get out of the auction and continue to live there because it'll lower the payments enough so that they can live in it.
And well, you're absolutely right. That's the common sense approach, is why not sit down with the existing homeowner who has not been able to make these payments, because a lot of the payments they signed up for, they were paying lower interest rates, and they have these adjustable rates. They went way up. Some people refinanced their house and also got an adjustable rate with the refinancing, and now that new rate is in, and they just can't make those those payments. And you're right, if you sit down and pencil it out, it's a lot more cost effective for the banks and the lending companies to keep those people in their houses by renegotiating something that they can pay. Maybe it's over a longer period of time, but it keeps them in that house. The minute you start moving people in and out, the costs drive up, houses get abandoned, they don't get taken care of, they fall into disrepair, they start hurting the neighborhood, the taxes go down, the cities and schools who rely on those property taxes are now losing it. Just everything that's sort of triggered by sort of forcing people out of their homes is not a very positive result. So I hope in this bill that we just passed in Congress, essentially encourages, we can't, this is all private contract, and we encourage them to go back and renegotiate and to try to keep people in their houses. And that's the lending process that we've backed up with Fannie Mae and Fannie Mac allows that to happen.
Thank you very much. Our next question comes from Chuck from Hollister about impeachment. Chuck, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Yes, hi, Congressman Farr. Yes, I've been following you for quite some time. I think if you followed my past emails to you and so forth, that I am a Republican, but I'm also a Vietnam veteran, and I'm very much for what you're doing relative to the impeachment of George Bush. I think that it would be much appropriate if you were Speaker of the House so we could actually get this job done. I really would like to find out where are we in the process and will it actually happen before he's out of office?
Well, let me answer the last part of that question first. It won't happen because we're just running out of time. We have 4 weeks left of session. The impeachment process is a lot, much like a grand jury at the local level where you come up with articles of impeachment, which are like articles of indictment, and then they are referred to the court to hear the, and in this case, the Congress, the House, sets out the articles of impeachment and has to have a hearing on them in committee, Judiciary Committee, and to then have a vote on them. And if there's a majority vote to move forward, then send the bill to the floor, and obviously it's debated there up or down, and sent to the Senate where the trial begins. So that process, when we had a special counsel paid for by taxpayers who had done many years of work, Ken Starr, in his work, ended up, remember, the Republicans were in control of the House, and it was their interest to bring these articles of impeachment against Mr. Clinton, and they were successful in doing that. However, the Senate voted not to impeach him. So that process took about 13, 14 months, and we just, with 3 weeks left, we don't have it. Now, what we have done is Dennis Kucinich has the articles of impeachment. We have sent them to the Judiciary Committee. A hearing was held on those last week. It's just the first of others. We can't do it. So, because the other thing is the Speaker and the Senate leader says the votes aren't there to get this done in the amount of time. There aren't enough people that feel as strongly as you do about it. I have, as you know, co-sponsored these bills. And so what we're seeing is a clock turn against us. Now, one thing that I have learned from the Judiciary Committee is that, indeed, if crimes have been committed by this administration, they aren't immune from criminal indictments and sanctions after they leave office. So it doesn't mean that the misdeeds of this administration can't also be prosecuted in the years out. And I think there'll be a lot of attention paid to trying to do that.
Thank you very much. Callers, remember, if you have a question for Congressman Sam Farr, press *3 at any point during the call, and somebody will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Gary Gerbrandt from Soledad. He has a question about the Monterey County rail system. Gary, you're live with Congressman Farr.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Gary.
How are you doing?
Pretty well. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing really well, thank you.
What's your question?
Well. Yeah. This last week there were some articles on TV and in the papers regarding the rail industry wanting to to increase their ability to ship produce and perishable goods by rail and get back into the market and that sort of thing. My question isn't related to that per se, but assuming that something would be done to help, you know, build up that particular infrastructure, is there any way that you can keep in mind the need for the passenger rail service, you know, from, you know, through Monterey County that we've been working on at the Tampa level?
Well, thank you for asking the question, because today it was circulating on the floor with the Santa Clara legislators, so Lofgren, Annie Eshoo, Mike Honda, and a few others, to sign a letter that I'm sending to the Undersecretary of Transportation here in Washington to support the extension of the Caltrain to Salinas. As you know, it's incrementally moving down the corridor. We have the corridor, which is wonderful. Many of the other areas don't have a corridor, or their corridor is not brought up to commercial, like the line to Monterey could never be used because its tracks haven't been repaired or fixed for years. And you know, I think the last time they had a train on there, it couldn't go over 10 miles an hour. But to Salinas and Soledad and South County, obviously Amtrak runs through it every day, and the commercial freight comes through it. There's two things about it. One is the Caltrain is operated by the state of California, and it's an expensive venture because they have to lease all the track. They have to lease they build their own cars, but the personnel have to come from the train unions and so on. And we're working on that because I think it would alleviate a lot of the congestion that we have in the Prunedale Bypass. And certainly you brought up a whole new idea, which is not new to Monterey County, but relatively new to get it on the page again, which is shipping produce by rail. I remember, and I don't know if anybody's revisited that, but when I was in the Board of Supervisors in the 70s, there was a big push to take the, after the Firestone plant closed, to use that as a, because they have rail connections inside the building there, to be able to use that as a freight where you could put the trucks, the trailer rigs on train cars, and you need a system to do that, a place to do that, and as I recall, we'd actually gone through the planning and have those ideas. We ought to pull those out because it may be cost effective to do that again. But I'm keen on, we've got a rail service in Monterey County. We're blessed to have that, and we ought to use it for both a passenger local as we're using it now. I mean, you can get on the Salinas train and train in Salinas and go anywhere in the United States, and that's wonderful. But that's, you go to, you know, you don't have a commute train. And in the East Coast, we have a lot of these back here, and they're heavily used. So I'm excited to keep those opportunities on the board and spend the money planning that we need to do to get it realized.
Thank you. Remember, if you are waiting to ask a question, please be ready to give one of our town hall assistants your name, your city, and your question. And if you have a question for Congressman Farr, please press *3 and someone will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Will from Hollister about bringing the military back from Walter Reed and Katrina. Will, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Yes, Congressman, thank you very much. This is, I was telling your assistant, this is a great idea. I'm just blown away by this. Anyway, I'll try to be brief with my question. It's a broad question. The situation going on with Blackwater, the disgrace at Reed Medical Center, the disgrace with this shower, whatever's going on with the electrical system in the showers, the private contractors in the military, and also I'd like to tie that in with Katrina and, in my view, the lack of action with really going in there and fixing this up. I mean, we're all told that we live in the greatest country in the world, the most powerful country, the best economic situation worldwide, yet I see some fundamental breakdowns in the overall systems that we have here. And quite frankly, when all of these situations came about, I personally was shocked to think that some of these issues would even come up because we're supposed to be the biggest and the best.
So, Will, what's your question?
My question is, what – is being done to rein in the private contractors in the military? What's the status of the Reed Medical Center situation? Do you have any idea what's going on with the showers, although I know it's a new issue and it's probably still under investigation? And what could we do for the people in New Orleans?
Well, those are those are great questions, and obviously ones that, that need a lot of response, and I'll try to get through them as fast as I can. First of all, I really thank you for that. You know, I sit on the Veterans Appropriations Committee, which sets up the whole Department of Veterans Affairs as well as all the military buildings, including the Walter Reed Hospital. And you may, if you have cable television in your house, you may want to turn on, I think we're going to bring this up about 4 o'clock Washington time, which is about 1 o'clock your time, but if you have an opportunity, you will see the debate on the veterans funding, because tomorrow we will be spending more money on veterans issues than ever in history, and I'm very excited about what we've done to kind of tighten it up and shape it up and make it a lot more responsible to the needs of a veteran community, including what we've done with Walter Reed and putting a lot of money into it to make sure and firing people who were in charge and turning that around to be it's as many people may not know, but when you're an injured in Iraq or Afghanistan, you go to Germany for immediate field treatment, and then when they get you stabilized enough that you can fly, which may be the next day, you're sent to Walter Reed Hospital or to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and there you're seriously, your operations and your treatment and your rehab is given to you before releasing you back to your community. And the idea is to bring, even if people who are severely injured, to bring them back to what they call athletic capability, the idea that you went into the military, you were as good a shape as an athlete, and even with a disability, you're going to be able to be doing things. So we're sitting on the committee that oversees all this, and we're insisting that this be done right and being done well and being done very professionally, and there's just a lot of advances that I'm very excited about. But a couple of things. The Walter Reed Hospital is, we've had the oversight hearings, and we've closed down that bad opportunity, and we're fixing the things that need to be fixing, and we've brought in new management. The New Orleans issue, we had a bunch of congressmen in New Orleans last week. We're doing still follow-up of the Katrina disaster. And the contracting out in Iraq and Afghanistan is something that I am very appalled at. I think it's being the ugliest America. Everything we try to do is good, and then when we do these private contractors, we end up showing the ugly side of America. And you know, we rebuilt Europe after World War II, and we used no private contracts and certainly no American contractors. And we kept using the Marshall Plan as what we try to do to these countries like Iraq and Afghanistan. But obviously, we can't do it with people who are only interested in making money and not interested in working themselves out of a job, which is what a private contractor should do, by leaving the capacity in the host country to do it themselves. So we're reforming that, and I think with a new president, we're going to be cutting off a lot of those contract opportunities. Lastly, I'd just like to say that, not a part of your question, but veterans need to know that I am keen on, we've created a veterans clinic at the former Fort Ord, and anybody with an honorable discharge can use it. The feedback I have is it's the best medicine they've been able to receive in their life, that it is the cost of prescription drugs is the cheapest of any program they've seen. We're trying to expand that clinic to merge it with the active duty military families who have a private insurance called, or public insurance called TRICARE. It's sort of like Blue Cross for military families. And the doctors be brought in to have both a civilian and veteran a clinic that will be just top-notch. And I'm actively working to get this Central Coast State Veterans Cemetery built. So I think that the clinic in Capitola, the clinic in Fort Ord, the cemetery, that we will really be a community that provides for the needs of our local veterans, and I'm very proud to do that. I thank you for your question.
Callers, remember, if you have a question for the congressman during the broadcast, please press *3 at any time during the call. Our next question comes from Mr. Padilla from Prunedale about the Comprehensive Immigration Bill. You are live with Congressman Farr.
Hello, Sam.
Hello, how are you?
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Sam, I mean, right now, because of the, number one priority is the economy and the high cost of gas and so on, they've been forgetting about the comprehensive immigration bill. Is anything going now that you know of?
Well, as I said earlier in the program, Congress has just tomorrow before we and Friday before we adjourn for a month, which is a scheduled summer vacation to get members back with their families and kids before they all go back to school. And then we come back in September and possibly October to be here, and then we're all we have to get home because everybody in the House of Representatives is up for election in November, and a third of the Senate is. So the comprehensive immigration reform package, which I'm very pleased that the president took a very strong stand on and wanted it. The political plan was to get that through the Senate first and then to have the House take it up. It was they had the votes, and then all of a sudden the bill started getting attacked from all different angles, and many of the senators who were up for re-election this year felt that they had to change their position from support to opposition, and the bill could not get sufficient votes in the Senate to get passed to the House. So since we couldn't pass it in the Senate, we haven't taken it up on the House side. And I think the issue is dead until early next year. We obviously have to find an answer to this. This is not, you can't just sort of throw all the money at the border, which we've done a lot of. But we need to find a way for people to find a process where they can move from being illegal to at least having a status that can be investigated, and they can do things like learn English and take tests and pay a fee to move to a green card status. And after a long time in a green card status, one could then, if they were still interested, apply for citizenship. But it would take about 16 years to get there. I'm very interested in getting this comprehensive package passed. It's in the interest of the people who own businesses and have employees. It's interest in the schools and the communities. And certainly I know a lot of people just in interest of keeping families together want this comprehensive immigration reform.
Thank you very much. Our next question comes from Kathleen from Watsonville. Her question is about Medicaid funding and doctor reimbursement rates. Kathleen, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Thank you. Thank you. And I want to thank you, Mr. Farr, for your efforts and of you and your compatriots in Congress in enacting a moratorium on the administrative cuts to Medicaid. Unfortunately, it came too late to save the three school nurse positions that were cut in our district that were funded through Medi-Cal's administrative activities. And the moratorium is a great thing, but it only lasts until the 1st of April next year. So I wanted to know what you can do to support making that moratorium permanent, and in fact, besides restoring those funds, expanding the funds that pay for school-based services and linkages between our students and health services, which you should understand in our community are one of the primary ways that families access health care services is through school. And I'm also hoping you can work to raise reimbursement for our providers in our so-called rural communities, which really makes it hard for us to attract and retain health staff. Are you on track with me there?
Yes, I'm on track. And, Catherine, thank you very much. Which county do you live in?
I live in Santa Cruz County, and
Santa
I live
Cruz
in
County.
Watsonville.
Well, it's
but our Watsonville community goes, our schools go through both counties.
Well, let me sort of take your questioning backwards. The sustained growth rate, which Congress delayed, which was to be cut by 10%, as you indicated, we've delayed that, and it's in law, and we just keep suspending the law. And that helped. It just doesn't solve the problem, which you mentioned, which is the geographical practice cost instinct, known as the GPSI. And both Monterey, Santa Cruz, and San Benito, all three counties, are affected by having the lowest reimbursement rate in the United States, whereas Santa Clara and the San Francisco Bay Area counties have the largest reimbursement, the highest reimbursement rate in the United States. So it's just unfair for doctors who are practicing and seeing Medicare patients in those three, in our three counties, to get such a low rate when the cost of living is just as high in Santa Cruz as it is in Santa Clara. And I'm working, I think, probably harder than anybody in Congress to get that geographical price cost index changed and brought up to the Santa Clara level. How we're gonna revisit all this next year. Obviously, we have to because we've only delayed the cuts for a few months. But we'll have a new administration. The administration is committed to, and I think it's going to be the Barack administration, is committed to a comprehensive health care reform. And you can't deal with comprehensive health care reform without dealing with all of these, including the school nurse, because the school nurse is the first responder to medical needs. Children oftentimes are the canary in the coal mine by the colds they get and the infections they get, and the first person to see them oftentimes is a school nurse. So we need to, and we certainly don't want sick children, because we don't want that. We don't accept that, and we need to make sure that they get the attention they have, and the society needs to know that that's very valuable for society, because if the children get infected, all children get infected, and then the whole community gets infected. So the ounce of prevention is really worth the pound of cure. The cuts, I think in this case, were created by the state of California, not by the federal government. And you have to talk to John Laird and Anna Caviero as to exactly why they cut out the school nurse program. But I really appreciate your question.
Thank you very much. Remember, if you are waiting to ask a question, please be ready to give one of our town hall assistants your name, your city, and your question. And if you have a question, press *3 and someone will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Frank from Soledad. Frank has a question about health insurance. Frank, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Good afternoon, Mr. Congressman Farr. My question is that health insurance for me is hard because I'm a single parent of a disabled child, quadriplegic, and I work for IHSS, which is called In-Home Support Service. I have a union that's SEIU. I do pay contributions to the union every month, and I've been working with my daughter for about a year and a half since I used to work for Smucker's in Salinas, Monterey County, who moved out of Salinas, closed the doors on us, and obviously I'm stuck with but no health insurance. The question is that I am eligible to have a health insurance since I am a full-time caregiver, and I have the requirement hours being worked to qualify, and I do work them. And the thing is that because the county cannot agree with the union and the state, I am left out without insurance because if you listen to me, I am eligible, but because there's a block to getting new health insurance for new workers, I'm considered still a new worker because at the time they stopped the limit and they didn't.
Frank.
Yes.
If the insurance were available through your in-home supportive services contract, could you afford it?
Obviously, I'm paying for it. The money.
But you have some now.
Yes, I have. Listen to me. The question that I have is kind of tricky. I pay union fees to have insurance, and I'm eligible to have insurance, but because the county cannot agree with the state and the union, I am left out without the insurance. Now, I talked to Simone Salinas, the supervisor, you know, Mr. Salinas, and he basically gave me the number to the office, which I already had. You know, it's like what I'm
saying. Yeah, you know, I know what your problem is. You're eligible because you put in, because of your union requirements, you've met all those, but it isn't being offered to you, and you would have to pay even more. You'd have to have a copay, and I don't know what that would be, but there are other alternatives, too, particularly with your disabled child. And what I would suggest, because I can't just do this, all the details with you over the phone, and you don't want to share it with all the people that are listening to the phone, so it is very personal. What I would suggest that you do is call my office tomorrow in Salinas. That number is 424-2229, 424-2229, and ask for Nancy DeSerpa. She handles my Medicare issues, and we'll see what options are available for you. There are some as a care provider. There's also a lot of children's networks that might be able to assist you as well. We want to try to help you. So thank you for calling, and I'll follow up and tell Nancy to expect your call.
Our next question comes from Ray from Big Sur. Ray has a question about the fire. Ray, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Hi, Sam. It's Ray Sanborn. I have actually had two houses that were threatened by a fire here. And as you know, this has been a pretty traumatic experience for the entire community. And there are many people that I think have gotten frustrated and would love the opportunity to express their experience in a formalized public forum, you know, where testimony were controlled by testimony, et cetera. Yeah.
Ray, I'm ahead of you. We have a meeting scheduled in the Big Sur Lodge on Monday night. I think it's 7 o'clock.
That. It's scheduled for like 6 to 7, which is an hour and a half. It's not the
same. Well, we can go. I'll be there.
It's not the same as people coming and you know, we prepare testimony to, you know, to create a document that provides the history and the issues and, you know, it goes into it with more depth. And,
but we can, that's the place to start all that. It's a lot of, I'm very familiar. I've been in, you know, I was in that fire going through there up and down and a lot. And we've got a lot of postmortem, and I think what we can do, the community certainly showed its spirit. It's a wonderful community and caregiving and wonderful outreach. And there was a lot of miscommunication by the firefighters. There was a lot of miscommunication between the law enforcement and the folks on the ground. And I think what we can do is address how that'll never happen again. And that's what I'd like to do is make sure that if we're going to have another fire in Big Sur. These fires have been started by lightning about every 15 years, and or even sooner than that. And it's going to happen again. Let's just make sure that we don't have to suffer the way we did this time. It was a big, you know, it ended up, if you add the Indians fire and the Basin Complex fire, the two fires together, which they will never talk about as two because one was created by negligence, the Indians fire, and they're trying to pursue that in a criminal way. And they have to keep all the data on that fire separate from the fire that was started by lightning, which is the Basin Complex. Those two fires burned together, and I think together they are the largest fire ever in California history. And the money is still coming in, but we spent about $100 million trying to, you know, contain them. So there was a lot of stuff went on, and I hope you come Monday and we can start what we have to do, as you suggested, a programmatic public way of getting it on the record as to what went wrong. So I look forward to you at seeing you at the meeting.
Thank you very much. Remember, callers, if you have a question for Congressman Farr at any time during the broadcast, please press *3 and somebody will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Darcy Darcy from Corralitos. Darcy has a question about drilling and why drill instead of releasing oil from the reserve. Darcy, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Actually, that was Darcy Olson from Corralitos. And Congressman Farr, my question was, given the correlation over the last few years between the rise in fuel costs And the effect that it's having on people that are struggling to keep up with mortgages, as well as the effect that it's having on small businesses. Why is the president pushing for offshore oil drilling that's not going to yield any results for years to come, when releasing the oil reserves would bring immediate relief, particularly in an election year?
Well, I suggested that at the first part of the town hall meeting, and what Congress has been doing, we've been passing bill after bill, but guess what? The Republicans and the president have opposed them. So we've been, including the latest vote we took today, we'll have to go through a longer procedural, which just means we'll get it to the Senate. Whether they will have the votes to get it to the president, I don't know, but we had a bill today to require market transparency and accountability, would take the steps necessary to curb excessive speculation in the energy futures market, which we think would bring down gas prices. As I said, it was blocked by Republican votes. We have the Consumer Energy Supply Act, which would release a portion of the government's oil in the stockpile and the reserve. That's oil that we own, we have, and we have a record storage. We've never had this much in history. It's been used by presidents in the past for emergencies. This one could be argued as emergency, and it would, for a short time, bring down the price, but it would also play a much more significant effect in showing the market that we can play this game too. We can flood the market with oil that we own, and I think it would have a much stronger lasting effect than the president's willing to recognize. We passed a bill called Drill Responsibly in Leased Lands. Short name for it was Use It or Lose It. And that was failed. So we had a bill on cracking down on price gouging, the oil companies that artificially inflate the price, and that bill failed. We have called upon the president to allow responsible drilling in the National Petroleum Reserve, and that bill failed. So it has, as you stated, this has turned into a campaign for the November elections by keep blaming the Democrats, who are in the majority in both the House and the Senate, for not doing anything. And where we are trying to do it, we don't get enough votes because some of these require a supermajority to be passed in an emergency situation. And we've failed to get enough votes on the Republican side to do it. I think they want to keep it in front of the public as an issue. Unfortunately, it's penalizing all the people you mentioned. So I agree with you, and we're going to keep working at it. The best thing we can do is just follow the California lead in getting vehicles that are not only energy efficient, but are clean burning, and our conservation efforts, our alternative energy. We have the largest amount of wind energy and solar energy, and we use hydropower. We use geothermal with our volcanic activities in Northern California. We have lots of exciting new bioconversions available. Monterey County has the first biodiesel plant in California in operation. The Monterey bus fleet is going to try to be the first fleet in the United States, if not the world, to be run solely on biodiesel. We're starting to do some exciting things that I think will get us off this addiction to oil. If we all went out, the simplest thing is, if you got a car that makes 15 miles a gallon and you bought a car that makes 30 miles a gallon, you now get the oil as the same price it when it was $2 a gallon. So you've cut your cost in half by just increasing the mileage efficiency of your car. And because all this oil goes to transportation, the best way to try to get us less addicted to it is to have a much more fuel-efficient transportation system in America. Next question.
Thank you very much. Now, callers, remember, if you have a question for the congressman, please press *3 at any time during the call, and someone will be with you shortly. Our next question comes from Christine from Watsonville. Christine has a question about Cuba. Christine, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor. I have never been on a telephone town hall meeting before, and I think this is just brilliant.
Thank you, Christine.
Yeah. I have two campaigns that I feel strongly about. One is the Santa Cruz County Democratic Party handed out stickers. One is called Civil Marriages as a Civil Right, but that's not my question, but I just want you to know that I'm a straight Catholic, strongly in favor of marriage equality, if that ever comes up on your list. But the other thing is, the other campaign that I hold dear to my heart is the dropping of the embargo for against Cuba. I'm thinking it's really past time to be doing allowing commerce to go back and forth between us and Cuba. Certainly we're dealing with China and everybody else in the world. And what are the plans in Congress, and what is the talk in Congress about Cuba, or are Florida people holding this in check?
Well, Florida people are holding us a little bit in check, but less than they have in the past. When I arrived in Congress, I learned very quickly we didn't have a Cuba policy. We had a policy about it getting elected in Florida, and Cuba happened to be the beating whipping boy for that. But the business interests, particularly the agriculture interests in the United States, have rallied universally to open up trade channels with Cuba. And a lot of conservative senators and members of Congress have joined their governors and state legislators and business folks in trying to lift the embargo. The president, however, has told Congress that he no way will sign a bill that has that in it. And so we've been at loggerheads between Congress and the White House. In the meantime, some more Cuban legislators have been elected, Cuban Americans, and they have still trying to keep the embargoes and make the conditions very harsh. I happen to be a member of the Cuba Working Group, which is made up of an equal number of Democrats and Republicans who are all in favor of lifting the embargo, including the travel embargo, and to let Americans go to Cuba, let our folks trade. The rest of the countries of the world can go there. This is the only country in the world that our government tells you you can't visit. It's a crime to visit and spend money in Cuba. You can go to Iraq and Afghanistan if you can get in. You can go to, as you mentioned, and trade with all the other communist countries. It's the Cuba policy that we've had about Cuba is 40 years outdated, and we need to change it.
Thank you very much. Callers, remember, if you are waiting to ask a question, please be ready to give one of our town hall assistants your name, your city, and your question. Our next question comes from Carol Long from Santa Cruz. Carol has a question about the elections this fall and ballots. Carol, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Thank you. My question is, seeing that the elections, I believe the presidential election was stolen in 2000 and 2004 through voter fraud, what can be done, or what do you think can be done to make sure that that doesn't happen this fall? And also, the second part of the question is, how do you feel about paper ballots and hand counting, seeing that counting by computers is pretty much a secret counting of ballots, and I believe is not to be relied on?
Yeah, well, thank you for that question, Carol. Monterey County, as you know, is going to all paper ballots, which it, when I first registered to vote, and you had to be 21 in those days, all ballots were paper. We've kind of gone away from the traditional way in which we elected people to just trying to do it electronically. Some of that has been pressured by the disabilities community that feels that, I'm very sympathetic to their needs, that the paper ballot has to be filled. If you're blind, it has to be filled out by you telling somebody, and that's sort of a violation of your privacy. And others have to have other people fill it out. So they have filed suit, which requires that when we do have machines, we have to make that they have to be usable by disabled folks. The Secretary of State in each state is to certify whether these machines meet federal law and state law, and our Secretary of State has indicated, I think that the latest thing I heard is that she hasn't felt that the vending companies have met the requirements the state have set up, which is that it has to have three independently viable ways of validating the vote. So I think that the electronic machines, by and large, are on hold. They're very expensive, too, and counties have to buy them. So paper ballots is much more cost-effective. It's the traditional way, and it's the way we elected people for many, many years. I'm a big fan of it. The bill in Congress to really help make these machines viable, the electronic voting, was defeated by Republicans again, and it's too bad because we saw that there was voter fraud even in the last election, and that, you know, for the rest of the world, that looking at America, when we have we're denying people access to votes and then having votes not counted and lost and things like that, it's a real black eye for a country that prides itself in an open democracy and a freedom and privilege to vote. And so we need to clean this up. We need to make the vote process accessible, usable, and honest. And I'm doing everything I can to ensure that.
Thank you very much. We have time for one more live question, but for everyone still on the call, especially those who have questions that we haven't had a chance to address today, you will have a chance to leave a voicemail for the Congressman at the end of the call, so please stay with us. So our last question comes from Butch from Big Sur, who would like to talk about the fire recently. Butch, you are live with Congressman Farr.
Hello, Sam. This is Butch Cronland. I wear a lot of hats in this community. I'm on the board of the CPOA Coast Property Owners Association. I'm also president of my water company here at Coastlands, and I'm also a general contractor. So,
You've been busy.
Well, Sam, as you well know, Big Sur is a place of volunteerism, and we are in full mode right now. I really enjoyed hearing what Ray had to say regarding the breakdown in terms of the fire and how that was managed and how the our local government, you know, chose to play the game. But that's for another day. My a couple of things. First off, I really want to express my appreciation for, you know, the people, you know, as I'm sitting on the phone and listening to things, you know, the voter fraud issue regarding the transfer of power, you know, from Republican or Democrat to Republican over the course of the last 8 years. I'm also very, very interested in terms of Medicare and our ability to reimburse for that. That's a
Butch. Can I get to the question? Because I'm being given a sign that we're running out of time.
I guess where I would go for here, Sam, is the most important thing for our community right now is for Congress to get their ass in gear and budget once the Bear Team is through with their effort and the NRCS is done with their effort. For Congress to budget the money to be able to protect Big Sur in terms of its watersheds, because
well, we will.
Okay, well that's a very big issue here, and we're very concerned.
Did you hear my invitation? I know you're all aware of it, but Monday night we're meeting with the multi-agency council board in the Big Sur Lodge to hear from the public, sort of the postmortem on the fire. And we're going to have two meetings, one just to let everybody get it out, which we need. And by the way, I'm very much on the side of the residents on this. You know, I'm a part-time resident myself, hopefully. I mean, that night I'm driving up from my property in the South Coast to attend the meeting. And then we're going to have a second session to sort of figure out how do we prepare for the winter and the next onslaught of issues, which will bring up that implementation and budget for the Bear Team advice. So I really hope that you'll be there and bring your neighbors and friends. We can work these things out. I'm very positive. It's a great community. It has a lot of it's you know, for a rural community that deals with adverse elements all the time, from storms of hurricane strength, and certainly road closures and water problems and bridges washing out to fires. we know how to live in the wilderness and to cope and get along, and we just have to make sure that in the future we don't have the kind of confusion that developed with this fire. So I appreciate your interest, and I would look forward to your recommendations. And I understand we're kind of running out of time, so I'd just like to sort of close by thanking everybody for paying attention to this and staying and listening, and if you like it, I'll do a lot more. And my time's up, so have a safe night, and thank you very much. If you want to leave a message right after I hang up, you can do that. The electronics allow you to do that, and tomorrow all of this will be replayable on our website. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being good citizens of the great United States of America. Bye-bye.